So, should I speak with the mic here?
Yes, that's the right one.
So let me start by thanking you for this time to discuss the movie and letting you know a little bit of where I come from when I'm talking about the narrative. And I've been doing field work in Mexico and Colombia for the last 9 years. I started in 2011 in Colombia, talking with relatives as they disappeared. And my own country, Mexico, was going through a very special time, 2011, which until then was one of the bloodiest years in Mexican history. I left Mexico City in 2007, so the war on drugs was just starting, and I was doing my PhD on the anthropology of science, how people kind of produce genetic science and knowledge and so far. And my first postdoc was in Colombia, and then I started talking with victims of violence, especially disappearance, that were engaging with genetic science to find the whereabouts of their loved ones. And I come from that angle, from the kind of like the party pooper, right, the ethnographer that comes with their nuances. But there are a couple of issues that I find really problematic with the film, even though we endorsed it and we showed it, and I think it's a fantastic film. One of which is the masks, the commitment to effacing the victims without really erasing their voices or other kind of like very important identifiable traits. And let me read a bit, bits and pieces of the talk, but I think that the freedom of the devil is centered on trauma. So it's really trauma-centric. It's all about pain and loss. And it dwells in the narcotic effects of violence on the one hand, and its disruptive, emotionally shattering, and life-threatening dimensions on the other. Also, everyone is wounded. So these masks are not neutral. The masks tell you about being wounded, about being burnt, about having something to kind of like keep behind the masks. And these are very different masks from others we know very well from Mexico, the Zapatistas masks, right? So these masks are showing you someone that is purposefully hiding himself behind the mask to kind of pay attention to the struggle. Here, I think that's not the case. So if we have to think about these two different masks, I think they are different devices to talk about pain and loss. And they are also different devices in terms of what is important to talk about. So the masks used by Everardo are masks that have the lingering sensation that those behind them have suffered from wounds that cannot be revealed without putting at peril the viewer or the interviewee. What are the wounds that these masks are concealing for the viewers of the film? So in this talk, I want to dislocate the topographies of violence and trauma that the makers of The Devil's Freedom talk about and make present in their film through the personal narratives of victims and perpetrators what I think are other topographies of moral intimacy. So I think that's the other, so that's the second problematic thing in the movie, that is all about this intimacy that is depoliticized, right? It's all about this very subjective pain that cannot be explained, and you need to find that guy that killed your family. And I can remember these ethical dialogues in my primary school in Mexico, because we have dealt with violence for a long time. So this is for us ethics 101 when we are 7 years old, okay? And I think that's really problematic when we present a film, especially because some of us grew up in the midst of kidnappings and violence. I grew up in Estado de México and Mundo E. So if any of you come from Mexico, I think I have a couple of Mexicans here. And that was the El Mocho Orejas, that the 90s kidnapping was a big thing. And lots of the mothers of my friends were kidnapped. And some of them have these stories of being saved by they're kind of being brave and throwing themselves out of cars. So we know about this stuff. So how can we treat these moral encounters in different ways? How the ethics of talking about perpetrators of crime, or actually the abusers or the killers, the kidnappers, the criminals and the victims of violence in much more productive ways? So I want to try, as I say try, because it's a very difficult topic to bring the nuances and the gray areas, to think about the more than human, the less human-centered narrative. So one of the classic tropes of human rights is that we are lost, our humanity is lost somehow through violence. But that's pretty not true in many ways. Violence is deeply human. And extreme violence, supreme violence, is something that bounds humanity in so many ways. Exhibiting that violence not so long ago was one of the pleasures that medieval knights sang about. How torturing others and dismembering others was this kind of like pleasure beyond sex or other pleasures or other kind of worldly pleasures. So not long ago, violence was seen in a very different light. And now we have equated humanness with not putting anyone else in danger or enacting scary, violent acts on them. And I think that's problematic, not because I'm against human rights, but because it flattens the narratives of what we can do with them and what is actually going on here. So that's why I'm talking about the more than human here. And let me start with something that happened in one of the beautiful chats we had in a coffee in Polanco with one of the mothers searching for her kid for 10, 12 years now. And she was telling us how this is all names that all of these are celebrities. In fact, if some of you know anything about Mexico, you have seen some of the people that are pretty much every time in the newspapers. All right, so the faces, the voices here are people very present in the public sphere. And anyone can recognize them if they spend enough time following the news and the TV in Mexico. So that's the other thing, right? So you're taking out their face, but actually they are really recognizable. And the voices here are voices that are really dominant in that field. But let me start with what I call the avocado plants, hummingbirds, and disappearances. So basically, this is a mother telling me that her son, Victor Hugo, had disappeared, and she knew that he was kidnapped and killed because the kidnapper sent some pictures. And she's searching for her son in Michoacán, and as you know, Michoacán is famous for avocados, right? Aguacates in Spanish. And they are like blood avocados, if you like. They're full of these kind of the turf wars and kind of like the drug dealers trying to make a profit out of controlling that field. So you know the story. If you don't know it, I'm not going to go into lots of detail, but it's very interesting. And her son was killed and kidnapped there. He was a policeman, and he was sent, as they were saying, without lots of support in one of the most dangerous sites in Mexico. For her, this was a clear act of the police forces trying to get rid of him and actually sacrificing her son. And she can actually, she has lots of compelling evidence showing that. But the interesting thing for me when I talk with Delia, I'm going to call her Delia because she's very famous and I want to not to use her name, was when she narrated how she decided to become one of these mother activists. And it was through this very painful and depressing time of coming close to Mother's Day that she started dreaming with Victor Hugo. And Victor Hugo would appear in a cloud, right, and would start playing the favorite cumbia of her mother and would invite her to start dancing. And then she started getting this sense that she should do something to bring Victor Hugo to life. So what she did was bring one of the avocado seeds of the field she was searching for her body, and she planted that avocado field in her backyard. And then the avocado plant started growing. And she knew that the spirit of Victor Hugo was there because the hummingbirds were flying all around that. So if any of you are Mexican or know anything about Latin American indigenous cosmologies, hummingbirds are the people, are the messengers that connect the otherworldly spheres with this world. And it's very important. It's a very important symbol for disappeared. There are NGOs that are called Colibri. So this was the marker. The very sad story was when her puppy ate the avocado plant. And of course, he got expelled from the household. And she patiently waited for the avocado plant to grow again, okay, and tender this avocado plant. And then she decided, as many of you might know and might have heard in this story, that she needed to find and talk with those that killed and kidnapped her son. And this is a defining moment. This is something really interesting from this movie that is very flat. A defining moment in this Christian cosmology is to find forgiveness, to give forgiveness. So closing never comes through bodies, comes through this act of self, kind of like gratification, but also selflessness. So it's both things at the same time. It's selflessness because you're going beyond hatred, but it's also self-gratification because you are achieving that greatness. And many of the relatives would talk about this moment as their true calling to become one of the leader activists you see here. These people are people that have gone public, many of them with death threats, and I can tell you a couple of them have chauffeurs and bodyguards paid by the state, okay? So it's a very complex topography, one that I think is very interesting. So this is the first snapshot. So I'm trying to bring my ethnographic kind of experience to talk with that bit of the movie. Let's bring another snapshot. So, I mean, if you are academically minded, you might want to know where all these snapshots come from. So we did 1 year of field work in Mexico, and I'm happy to have Dr. Cruz Santiago here, who did all this field work with me. She's one of the co-investigators. With families building this DNA database. So we actually interviewed them, talked with them, followed them to the PGR. We met the guy that created La Verdad Histórica. So it was a fantastic year, a couple of months before Ayotzinapa happened, that actually changed the landscape of the Isapir. When we started this project, the Isapir were something that people were talking about in a very different way. The 43 changed that landscape. And suddenly we had Al Jazeera and the cameras and everyone paying attention to what we were doing. And the mothers and fathers of the disappeared started getting a lot more media attention. So there was a shift here. And it comes from all those interviews, from the work we have done in workshops, and from a new set of 65 interviews plus 17 workshops we conducted, just finished last year, in Mexico, to try to think about violence in a more nuanced way. So this second snapshot comes from more recent field work. This is not so much with relatives disappear, but was a visit we did to one of the so-called centros de rehabilitación, okay, which are kind of correctional facilities in Mexico that now have a new narrative that is basically to bring the youngsters to readapt and reintegrate to Mexican society. And this was for us really important because what they say here is also another key message. The people that are committing the most atrocious crimes are youngsters. They are 13, 14, because if they get caught, then they have 5 years. So even though the intellectual kind of like big brains of the operation is never caught, because he is well beyond those activities, he's able to recruit lots of youngsters to do these things. And that's one of the ways in which we can know how they operate, okay? So this interview was really interesting because it brought a different angle to us. I was, to be honest, I felt like I was going to faint in many, many moments of the interview. I'm very weak when it comes to narratives. And this guy was slowly telling us he was getting much more excited with the story as he told us how he took the organs out of people, how he sold, and all these kind of like very explicit materials. And you could see how this was becoming something interesting for him. Not because he was giving us information, but because he was kind of reenacting these moments. And it became weird because we were there, lots of us, and also the kind of the police officer, that he tried to kind of diffuse the attention. But it was not just the narrative of, you know, forgiveness and a kid that is crazy and wants money. There was something else going on. And this was the real pleasure of having control over someone. And that's why I call it dismembering bodies and the pleasures of torture, because this specific narrative, this specific other world, was not just about inequality and poor Mexicans being recruited. It was also about this maybe medieval, if you think, this other kind of like more primal thing of dismembering the other and finding that power is not just power of life and death, but also of commodifying the body parts, of selling the people they kidnap. And as I told you, this is nothing new, right? Not in the Aztec culture. You have the Coyoacatli here, and she was a stark reminder that females that misbehaved in the Aztec world could find the fate of dismembering. But also, you can find that in the history of Mexico. And this is interesting because in one of the conferences we attended, the leader of the now FGR, the Fiscalía General, in those days, I think it was PGR, told us that Mexico was facing violence because we had an incomplete mestizaje. This was, you know, the old trope, the old narrative of we are a failed national project, therefore we have violence. I think that's not the case. It's actually because we are successful that we have that sort of violence, that violence is at the center of what's going on. And I think that's one of the angles I want you to, if there's a takeaway in this talk, that's one of the takeaways. Mexico is not a failed democracy or failed state. It's operating perfectly fine for what it has been designed to do, right? And the state is not new that these tortures are going on. That maybe the new thing is that we are now paying attention. The thing that most people asked me when this happened was, why the 43? if they have killed so many indigenous people in Mexico before, they have done all these massacres, why we pay attention now? And maybe this is a question we need to ask. So just to close this one, I remember at the end of a very long interview for me, I was exhausted after all this catalog, and I feel the same when I see this film. This is a catalog of horrors to me, right? The way in which it's all about how I do things, how I feel in my very personal sphere about this. And he told us very openly about all the things he did and how he was framed. He was only captured because the policemen who allowed him to operate decided by some who knows what to give him to other policemen that were not part of the band. And then they knew that he had an old lady dismembered or killed. He didn't get into all the details, but it was a bloody mess in his trunk. And that's how he got into jail. But he was just leaving 2 years. He was now, I think, 18, and he was caught when he was 15. And then he laughed at the end and said, like, well, this is useful for you? Because, you know, some of my patrons were very famous politicians, and all these kidnappings, some of them were just revenges. So we just make it look like a kidnapping. So you have this weird sensation that he knew he was not only hopeless, but he was cynical about the extent of anything changing. And that's why I'm telling you that maybe it's not that the system is failing or the state is failing, but maybe that the system is built to do precisely that. And I think there's not a lot of that in the film, right? These kind of more collective, problematic sides of the activities of kidnappers is a little bit absent in favor of giving all these kind of personal weight to the narratives of pain. So there are other narratives that come with the mass graves. And this I remember because the person that is narrating about the bones talking is one of the very famous citizen searchers of mass graves. The voices and the style, the tone he speaks with is kind of like unmistakably recognizable by almost anyone. He's missing one of the things that are, I think, very interesting in Mexico, and it's these new forms of citizenship and care that are emerging. So it's not just the pain, it's not just the suffering, it's not just the loss, it's that this is engendering a new sort of citizenship. So people that were housewives before that maybe thought like, oh God, I would never get involved in any of those marches. They are just for stupid people and hippies that want to block our streets, are now becoming these very active social agents in Mexico. And I think they're the ones really changing the national public sphere and fighting the good fight, but also are enmeshing these very kind of like excessive bodies. And as Claire was giving the numbers, which I think are great to let you know the dimension of that, people narrate how the mortuaries were spilling, literally spilling bodies. There were so many bodies in Monterrey at one point, and I think you heard this from the people in Monterrey, that they had to put them in the street. There was no place for these corpses. And this is repeated everywhere in the country. So this is the excess I'm talking about, right? The excess of violence, blood, bodies, no infrastructure to deal with that, but also the abandonment of everyone else. So people are living, they don't tell you this in the story, and I think this is one of the great misgivings of having so much weight into the personal kind of narrative of loss and the trauma of what happened, that most of these people suffer from isolation. So the very instant that someone is abducted in your family, many believe you're doing something wrong. Because, I mean, this sense of self-preservation also affects others. And people would not be happy to go outside with you, to be friends with you, because they might be in danger as well. So these are kind of like the ethnographic narratives that I want to bring to this critique of the movie. And I'm not doing so well in time, right? I have like 5 more minutes.
Yeah, it's super interesting. Carry on.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, I wanted to talk about that. And I there's something else that I thought was really interesting in the stylistic representation of the mass grave. So all these very clean landscapes you see, right? This moment of tension, the music, the very kind of like the face. Whenever I went with families and they allowed me to go with them in the searches for bodies and even in mass graves, we knew that we were going to do some exhumations. Mass graves were always enmeshed with plastics, waste. They were mid dumpsters, mid something else. So pollution is ever present in these places. So the fact that you're trying to portray this clean world to tell you about trauma, I also find it as a very stylistic and interesting decision when it comes to filmmaking and talking about the mass graves, right? this beautiful forest with some fog. That's a very specific framing of solitude. And I think that's problematic because part of the journeys of these people is to separate dump from bones and caring for the dead in the middle of this mess and this pollution. And I find that fascinating in itself. In fact, one of the stories of the families is that they have searched in one specific region of the country so much that now plants have started to grow up again. So in fact, they are like bringing new plants to a place that was deforested before. And I find that really interesting in the more than human. Oh. And then the other beautiful thing about this is that we are losing one of the beautiful and scary things about Mexico. And I think this is something of a difficult topic because in some ways you don't want to reinterpretize Mexico like, oh, well, you know, it's just in Mexico different rules apply. You have rule of law here in the UK, and in Mexico we don't have rule of law. I think this is not what I'm trying to tell you. Selective rule of law is applied here, as we can see, in many ways, with the parliament suspended, all these little kind of like artifacts to make law bend to your will. Just imagine in Mexico that's much more plastic. Okay? So there's a famous phrase that I always like to mention in every talk I give about Mexico, and this is attributed to Benito Juarez, one of the fathers, the founding fathers of Mexico, and that is, for my enemies, the law, for my friends, grace and justice. I think he intended it in a totally different way, but that's pretty much what I'm talking about here. And then before I show you some kind of like video of what we did and the close, I wanted to bring this band of El Zodiaco. So you probably, some of you were not even born when this was happening, who knows, but the whole thing of the band El Zodiaco is like a snapshot of Mexican simulation, okay? So somehow, Mexican TV got to know when a real, kind of like, they were gonna be capturing some kidnappers. And they were all filming all that in real time. Yeah, I heard someone laughing. Someone know about that. Oh, yes. Yes, so they actually had already arranged the scene. And the policeman that was organizing that, the head of police, is now on trial in New York, Genaro Garcia Luna, who was, everybody knew this. This was a secret, like an open secret. Whenever we interview family, they told us, oh, yeah, Genaro Garcia Luna is with the drug dealers. We know that he's the one blocking this. Of course, this rumor was so huge, but it's impossible for us to even talk about that in a paper because we would be liable of so many things. Now I can openly talk about this because everyone knew it. And Genaro Garcia Luna, who made the simulation in the time of Fox, of this band El Zodiaco that had a French citizen as part of the band, and they never actually found evidence of this band being actually the one kidnapping these people, are still in jail. This guy's still in jail. Israel Vallarte is still in jail. But all of this was set up. All of this was a fabrication to make visible to every Mexican that the police was working. So this real-time TV event was really fabricated from the beginning with the police, between the police and the TV. So that means that Mexicans know that evidence is probably fabricated. So the belief in the hardcore kind of justice system is a bit gone because of this plasticity. And the burden of evidence goes back to the families. This means that those that have to show that there has been a miscarriage of justice are the families. And none of that burden, of that emotional burden, is shown in the picture. And I think it's again, one of my issues of having these very clean landscapes between those that kill and those that are suffering. Right, so if we are going to be exploring the gray zones, maybe we need to do something else. And just to close, I think there's another narrative, very interesting narrative about power and how power operates through kind of violence and destroying bodies. And just to close this one, I want to come back to the Wounded Heroes narrative. And that Wounded Heroes narrative is that, as I told you, Delia was so happy that she could forgive the people that had killed and kidnapped her son. Well, it turns out, these are just images of us working with families trying to do a database, so you have a sense of what is the sort of work we do. But it turns out that these criminals were actually framed. And the fabrication is one of those things that Delia has now to deal with. So all her forgiveness, all this process of kind of like selflessness and becoming, overcoming loss, is actually tainted by simulation and the burden of proof, what I was talking just before. Because maybe the people she was forgiving might have nothing to do with the killing and disappearance of her son. Mm-hmm. And even though she's resisting these news, in the, I think last April when we interviewed the former, one of the former heads of security in Mexico, he was pretty sure that most of it was fabricated. So when this mother is telling you that these guys are denying that they were the killers or kidnappers of her son, they might be telling the truth, but who knows? So thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ernesto. Thanks, Ernesto. That was a fantastic counterpoint to the film, and I'm very pleased that you picked up on the grey zone in the relationship, potential relationship between victims and perpetrators, and the fact that they're not necessarily on in opposition to one another, but potentially on a continuum of some sort. I'm going to open this up to questions straight away. If you could say who you are before you ask your question, that would be great. And depending on how many I have, I'll take three at a time. Yeah, well, we just have one at the moment. So, yeah, in the pink T-shirt.
Experience when it comes to creating memory or trying to portray a public version of what was a traumatic event or an event of violence. For political reasons, sometimes the focus is left on the version of either the state or of the victims, but very few times we are able to lift the veil and understand what leads a criminal to become a criminal. So I guess what I'm trying to, I would like to hear a little bit more about what is your take on that. Complication of viewing different positionalities of victim perpetrator. It's very rare to also get the chance to see or hear a military, a person, someone from the military, to talk about, you know, what it means to be in the chain of command, what it means to not want to follow those orders, the consequences of following those orders, and that trope is especially important right now with regards with the new militarization that's happening. Portrayal of military power is trying to be shown as a certain panacea to violence. So I think that's why viewing these different is one of the things that I wrote about from this film. But I'm curious, because it seems like you got.
I think that's one of the highlights of the film. When you have that engagement with the military kind of ranks. Mm. And that's quite unique, because you don't have lots of those interviews, right? But what I'm trying to problematize here is that sometimes even the drug dealers are dressed in military garment, right? So the fact that one of the fascinating aspects of Mexico is you never know who you're speaking with. So I can tell you all these beautiful anecdotes of families searching for their loved ones when they thought they were talking with the leader of the police. They were actually the jefe de plaza. So that's why I brought Genaro García Luna into the mix. So you never know who you're really dealing. There's a phrase amongst anthropologists that say that Brazil and Mexico is not for beginners, right? Because you never know what's going on. And it's really not even for experts. I mean, it's really challenging. There's no way to know what is the ground you are kind of stepping on. So I think that's a golden nugget, especially the way they talk about these cemeteries, right? If one thing I'm disappointed with the new government, and I think that my vote was really about militarization, like, they told us that they were going to change this because we have like very, very strong evidence that this is not working, right? Like, we don't need more diagnostics. We know it's not working. That military are not trained to do police work, that actually they get scared because they get scared. They don't have enough intelligence. They kill people they shouldn't kill. Some of them are working with organized crime. So it's such a complex landscape that actually giving more firepower to the military kind of operation is a bad idea, at least for us. For those of us that have to circulate in Mexico. And even though I don't live there, anymore in like I used to. When I go and do fieldwork, I'm very aware of that. And you never know what's happening with the military. So I'm with you. I think that's one of the high points of this of the film. And I think there are many great things about the film. I think this is a great film and actually tells you lots of important details that are completely absent from the journalistic pieces. So my critique is completely unfair. If I had to compare these to other pieces out there, I think this is a masterpiece, right? So if this was compared to the public framing of violence in Mexico, this is just sublime. But thinking about these other nuanced narratives, I think it's ethics, it's 101. It's about this confrontation, about forgiveness, about what would you do to the bad guys. And I think Mexico brings into perspective how difficult it is to kind of know who the bad guy is, and if that bad guy is actually someone that is just a good guy in another kind of frame. And when I say that, I'm thinking about all the policemen I have interviewed that had died, right, after interviewing them, the journalists that had to actually cooperate with local organized crime to keep alive. So Mexicans have to live in this gray zone where we are not pure, we're not self-righteous. To survive, we need to engage with so many transactions that are seen as not desirable in so many ways. So that's one of the things. And I don't know, I mean, you have a hard job doing memorials. What is the memory? What do you want to rescue from these narratives? What do we need to make sure that the next generations are going to remember? And what are the duties we are giving to others in through building these memorial spaces, which I think is fascinating. I don't know, maybe you're thinking about the kind of all this movement of resignifying places where people have been killed. For instance, the Pozolero, I find those really difficult to engage with. It's not easy.
Can you actually explain something about that case to the audience? Because not everyone will know what that is, the Pozolero.
Okay, well, I don't want to bring all the grim details. I saw your faces when I talk about the kidnapper and the trunk and all that. So this is what they call cocina. So basically, some of the people they kidnap, abduct, disappear, end up in these places, which are like small industrial complexes in which they dissolve bodies. And then they throw this kind of like gooey jelly thing down some kind of tanks in the underground. Maybe if I'm mistaking my explanation, but I hope I'm okay. In these underground kind of like tanks in which the gelatin substance have some small fragments, bone fragments. And they go into those tanks to recover these fragments and see if they can sequence some DNA to identify people. And what they are trying to do in this kind of like resignification movement is to make a memorial just in that place, to make that place a space for commemorating and celebrating the life of those that have disappeared. And I think that's really interesting, and it's really troubling as well, and it confronts us with something that we Mexicans don't want to discuss a lot. One of the key findings of our previous project, we have done three big projects on disappearance in Latin America. We're doing a third one about data justice with all the spyware and Carmen Aristegui and what's going on with the grassroots movements. But in the last one, that was all about kidnapping, one of the findings was that 85% of people would actually not even want to talk about kidnapping. So they are not even eager to think that one of their family members might have been abducted. So they don't want to plan for that. So they refuse strongly. Some of them even left the room when we tried to do this exercise.
Yeah, if I could just make a quick comment on that. Because I think this method of disposal, body disposal, is particularly interesting, and I think this is where the memorial becomes important, is because it becomes impossible to reclaim and individuate the remains. And so a collective memorial stands in for the possibility of reclaiming and individuating the remains. So it's in a sense, it's a compensatory mechanism for that impossibility. But yeah, do we have more questions? Yeah, Rodrigo.
One of the things that caught my eye when watching this film is the gendered nature of the participants. You know, all the so-called perpetrators are male, whereas, you know, the analysts, the people searching are mostly female. Do you think going on in the country. Of, you know, we have in Latin America, obviously, the example of the Argentinian Madres de la Plaza de Mayo, this very feminine figure of the mother searching for her son, whereas the perpetrator is mostly seen as male. Do you think that that's a fair and accurate representation of the situation in the country?
I actually think it is, and it's not because there's no male kind of like searchers, citizen searchers that are actually digging mass graves or actively engaging with forensics and civic duties. There are a lot of males, but it is like an implicit division of labor that women are to be the faces of these issues. Actually, one of the few, maybe three. There are three more male voices that are this prominent in Mexico, because the rest are women. And that's that tradition about women being the motherly figure, the one that can speak in the public sphere, like with the Argentinian case, without being a threat to the state. So I think there's a tradition there, but it's also this very kind of like motherly love that is channeled in the disappeared, in the field of the disappeared. So it's all about this kind of engagement with motherly love in one way or another, finding the kid. And mothers used to tell us that men die faster. So when the couples do not split, most of their partners would die before them. So this is another interesting thing that maybe people haven't researched so much. But in this very small sample, if you like, the mothers were telling us, well, my partner died because of sadness before that happened. So it seems that this is also another reversal, that females are stronger to deal with this sort of loss. At least that's the narrative here. But in jails and in the statistics of crime, it's clearly a question about toxic masculinity when it comes to perpetrators. And it's very clear that there's this very male-dominated narrative. And I mean, there are few exceptions, La Reina del Sur and a couple of like prominent criminal, also sicarias that appear now and then. But I think it's mostly male. And yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to think about masculinity and the gender roles in the movie, but also in the way we frame the war on drugs. But yeah, I think it's pretty accurate. 80, 90% of the groups that search for disappeared are made of women. And also there's another logic to that, because some of the families need the men to keep on working to finance the searches. So I think there are many dimensions to that division of labor, so to speak.
Yeah, in the middle at the back with the white top. So can you say who you are, please?
My name is Maribel. I'm studying a Master in International Relations here. So my question, when you said that it is not that in Mexico maybe we are paying more attention to that, but the truth is that every year we are having more and more and more deaths. So my question is, like, if we have like a certain state of law, if the state has an objective, what is that objective? And is in these killings, it is perfecting its objective, or is actually something that it is getting out of hand?
That's a big macro question. I think we don't have enough tools to know that for sure. So one of the clear things is that our knowledge of what's going on in different regions of Mexico, for instance, Tamaulipas, not even the UN can go there. Mm. When we did fieldwork, we had to sneak from our previous university in the UK, who had a very stringent insurance process, to go to Iguala to make the DNA sampling and to work with the people there. And they have good reasons to do that. I mean, they were not exaggerating. Iguala was and still is a dangerous place. So one of the things that I found by reading some of the papers in Mexican academia is that what we have mostly are narratives coming from journalists that are doing the empirical work, and then academics kind of like get some of that and they develop their papers. Few of them have enough funding, time, and the contacts to do the fieldwork in those places where conflict is raging. And they need international partners to have enough leverage at some points to do that, because their institutions can also punish them.
So if you think about the way in which knowledge production is produced, then you have one of the main issues in Mexico. Then, and we are trying to do that, and this is one an interesting kind of emerging field in Exeter, trying to think about conflict and environmental costs, right? That's the other huge issue, because it seems when we started this project of kidnapping, it was clear for us that there was something weird going on, because there were lots of kidnapping in Puebla, lots of different kidnappings, and they were linked to oil theft or petrol theft, huachicoleo, but no one was burning up. There were no accidents. So if this was really this kind of disorganized thing in which you can see the kidnappings but you cannot see the accidents, it means that that is some sort of like, that is controlled to some degree, that people know when to go and take out the gasoline. So we started, by the absences of data, we started thinking that there was something going on there. And then with López Obrador, all this exploded with huachicol, right? And our kind of like, our suspicions were right. Mm-hmm. This was organized from the state. So when I was saying that this is not because Mexico is not working well, it's because it's actually working well, it's because the state is organized in such a way as to extract that money. It's quite a colonial thing if you think about it. There are some people that are safe, that have enough money and links, that they live in a completely different world from us. They don't even have to transit out the same streets we transit. And then it's the rest of us. And we are fair targets for all sorts of criminality. The interesting thing is that you would think, well, this is going to change when Mexicans, elite Mexicans, start suffering. But if you think about all the kidnappings, Martí, that these are very wealthy Mexicans, and not even them have an access to justice. So I think this is kind of like injustice by design. The fact that we have such a weak forensic system is just because we don't want the evidence to be there. Mm. And this actually is a system that is very well fine-tuned, that allows those that are more powerful to do what they want and never have enough evidence to change anything. So I'm very pessimistic about that, the links with the state. So that's why we talk about selective rule of law.
We've got another question at the back with the yellow top. Can you speak up just a little bit, please?
Yeah, sorry, just a couple of comments. So the first one, I think that the problem with the mask is, I think it's a failed attempt to show this sort of the banality of the evil. So I don't think it's trying to distinguish clearly between the victim and the perpetrators of the crimes, because actually with that sort of very problematic question, when he asked this girl, will you do the same, what he's trying to do in a problematic way is to blur that distinction. So I agree it's problematic, the divide, but I think it's problematic in a different way. Because you said some of these are very public figures, so I don't think they are really trying to hide their faces. It's more, I think, a failed attempt by the director to say, okay, we all are human beings, we can be on this side, on the other side of this issue, and there is a moment in which this distinction just gets very blurry. So I agree, it's a problematic device. I don't think it's an interesting solution to the problem, but I think the reason is a different one. And about this situation, there's no chance for a film or a visual device to give a complete version of a very complex situation. That's just the definition of art, showing in an impartial way what cannot be shown in any other way. But they are trying to do the best. I think it's a fail. There are lots of failures, there are lots of problems, but there is no scientific or artistic work that can show the complexity in a fair way, because as you said, we don't have the production of knowledge that is required for that reality to be presented in a clear way. But one of the problems here, I think, is that with this film in particular, in comparison to other films about disappearances, is that there's a lack of reflection on the historical background of this problem, because other films explain that very well when they go to interview the mothers or the relatives of some people disappear, and they tell you the story of the town, of the village, and how the police became corrupted and complicit with the local drug traffickers, and then this Canadian or British company who open these business mining companies, or I don't know, for extraction of petrol, and then the company hired the local and the local drug dealers to provide security for them. They needed to display the community. So there are other ways of telling this story that is way more interesting or more complex, and it's a little bit fairer to this complex reality.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, no, I don't have a question. I just want to maybe just add something, because I think it's very important that there is, in this lack of historical background, I think it's clear, very clear arguments and evidence. Going back to the 90s, and for instance, the Zapatistas have been very clear about that, how this logic of militarization is related to the implementation of NAFTA. So I agree completely with you what you say. The state is working well because they are basically destroying different structures that should be protecting people. Right? I just want to go back to the point of the army. Sorry, but I think...
But I think there are other people who want to ask questions as well.
Yeah,
so
I'm just going to say this. The point of the radical army, of the militarization is really... I think that's the main failure of the problem of the film, because it's not giving the whole account of how...
Sure. Yeah, that's okay. We got the point there. Do you want to respond to that, Ernesto?
Well, yeah, no. I think I agree. I agree with most of those issues. There's the militarization thing, but I don't think history would explain it enough. I think that there's a decision here to center on like the moment of trauma. So it's a trauma-centric movie, right? So the fact that we are not seeing the overlaps with other stories or the complexities, it's a specific decision. So that's why we don't see the garbage, we don't see the journeys, we don't see settings that are not very curated. So I think there's a very kind of emphatic decision of how we're going to present this. And I think this is a million years better than other things that I've seen, like Geographies of Pain, in which we just see the mothers crying and showing the rooms of their relatives. And Natalie and I have discussed this so many times that this is like one of those portrays of pain that kind of like frees people in this moment where you can only be a victim. So it gives you this kind of essentialized notion of what are your roles in this grand narrative of human rights. And I think that my critique is also going to this kind of neoliberal human rights agenda of like fighting for human rights in these individual like other places that are exotic and have dictators, but actually are not really touching in all these other things. So yeah, I think we're in the same kind of channel there.
Okay, we have time for one more question, really.
I'm Bruna Sev from Verbeck. Thank you very much for your talk and your critique. It really was very stimulating. But I suppose what I'm up against is the difficulty I had in thinking, simply because I felt quite not just bombarded but destabilized by two very different narratives. On one hand, there is a state that functions like clockwork, and on the other, there is the randomness and the ordinariness of the horror. And you also talk about sadism as being somehow embedded in the culture, in the dismembering, it goes back thousands of years and so on. So it's almost like every avenue is closed. We cannot think about this as an individual problem, the intimacy, for example. You're absolutely right. There is the depoliticization, but then we cannot think about the state, or we cannot think about resistance. What can we think about? What is the leap of faith? Where do we go with this? And I know it's a very difficult question to ask, because we've seen systems like this before. You know, we never thought we would see the end of the apartheid, for example. You know, because you see also the geopolitics behind it and everything else. But I think there is something about the gelatin mess that you described, which is very graphic, of this something that is toxic, that kills thought, and seems very difficult then to imagine a way out. So I don't know if you have any thoughts.
Actually, in that point, I have a very, very, very strong position for something.
Good.
So, so I think there are no ways out. Actually, I think that to even sit with the state in the way we do, what we call normalized contestation, the fact that NGOs are screening and asking the state for funds, and then the state can say, oh, you see, forensic team, I'm paying you, you cannot criticize me. you see NGO, you want your funding, stop making a mess. So the way we are kind of hardwired to the notion of the state to have these state-centric ambitions is completely is one of the root problems. I mean, who thought that it was a great idea to ask the state that is committing the crimes to go and punish himself? Mm-hmm. There's at the center of this whole thing is a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, part of what we do in our work is to talk about citizen-led forensics or citizen-led science as having alternative platforms. So what the whole idea of the DNA database is not because DNA is fantastic, it's just because this is governed, managed, and created by the very mothers of the disappeared. And no one can contaminate their own DNA, so it's a perfect place to start with citizen science. And to destabilize our notions of what is science and what is truth.
I'm going to stop you on that point. but I just want to thank you for a fantastic talk. It was a brilliant counterpoint to the film and really provocative, probably raised more questions than we were capable of dealing with in this time, but thank you. And thank you all for coming along for this event.